SMSs from
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Wednesday, March 25th, 2015. We're going to start at the bottom of the agenda today and open a public hearing on House Bill 3476.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 3476 comes to us from a variety of members, including our own representatives Leininger, Springer, and Olson. The bill creates a privilege in civil, criminal, administrative, and social and school proceedings for certain communications between victims seeking services related to sexual assault, domestic violence, or stalking, and qualified victims' advocates and services programs. House Bill 3476 prohibits disclosure of confidential communications without the consent of the victim. It declares an emergency, is effective on passage, and there are no amendments currently before the committee today.
Okay, thank you. Attorney General Rosenblum, please. And Leininger, Sherry Springer's not here yet. Jackie Myers is not here. Oh, Senator Gelser, Senator Gelser, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Ellen Rosenblum. I'm the Attorney General for Oregon, and I come to you today in support of House Bill 3476, which would provide a statutory privilege preventing the disclosure of confidential communications without a victim's permission. I'll be blunt about this. We are facing a crisis of sexual violence on our campuses. Nationally and in Oregon, one in five college women will become a victim of sexual assault, and nearly a third of college women will experience some form of dating violence. As unpleasant as it is to acknowledge the frequency of sexual violence on or around our college campuses, there is the additional question of why reporting rates trail so far behind what we know to be the frequency of these criminal acts. Experts agree that the majority of assaults are never reported, and most victims don't feel safe accessing the help they need and deserve. A possible answer lies in our failure to date in Oregon to provide safe harbor through confidential services to those in need. Oregon is one of only 10 states without confidentiality protections for victims seeking help from sexual assault or domestic violence victim advocates. When a college student has been sexually assaulted, she needs immediate access to confidential services that provide advocacy, support, and information about options. Without these services, a victim's path to recovery is rocky at best. We heard over the noon hour today at a rally from a victim of sexual assault regarding the feelings of shame and the debilitation that can arise in the aftermath of a sexual assault. It is no surprise that there's a strong correlation between sexual violence and future health, social, and educational problems. Students who've been victims are more likely to use drugs, suffer depression, consider suicide, and possibly even drop out of school altogether. So it hardly needs to be said that this is in sharp contrast to the excitement of going off to college for advanced learning and personal growth. So, under existing law in Oregon, students who have been victimized face a terrible dilemma. Come forward and seek help, which runs the risk of triggering an intimidating and invasive administrative process, or suffer alone. This administrative process exists because of a federal law known as Title IX, which requires colleges and universities to investigate all disclosures of assault on campus, regardless of a victim's wishes. Schools subject to Title IX will, however, recognize state laws that establish confidentiality protection for victim advocates, but Oregon law currently offers no such protection. It is time for Oregon to step forward and ensure the privacy of victims' communications and records. No student should fear that her conversations with an advocate might be shared without permission. No victim should have to fight the bureaucracy on her path to recovery. When a student knows that she has access to confidential services, she's more likely to seek the help that she needs. And when she seeks that help, her long-term physical, mental, and emotional harm is likely to be lessened. If and when she chooses to report, it will be on her own terms, not because she confided in an advocate for support. I am very proud to be a member of a broad and truly bipartisan coalition of legislators, educators, students, advocates, and law enforcement coming to you in support of House Bill 3476. You will hear the same story told from many perspectives, all pointing to the same conclusion. We have the opportunity today to help ease the transition from victim to survivor by making this fairly simple fix to our laws. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Senate District 8, which includes Albany, Corvallis, Philomath, Tangent, Millersburg, and unincorporated areas of Lynn and Benton counties. It is a privilege to sit here with the Attorney General and with Representative Leininger and with all of the people behind me and in the overflow room to speak in favor of this very common sense measure. It says one thing: your story matters. Your story is private, and you can get the help you need without the fear of your own words being used against you to humiliate or harm you at a later date. When we have individuals who are victims of sexual assault, whether they are men or women, it's often very difficult to get them to reach out for the help that they need for fear of judgment, shame, and embarrassment. Unfortunately, our current law gives some credence to that because their words can come back to re-victimize them again in the future in ways that they don't approve of and do not need. I'm so grateful to our Attorney General for all of the work that her office has put into crafting this bill. It's important legislation, and our students will be safer for it. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Chair Barker and members of the committee, I'm State Representative Ann Leininger, and I'm here to testify in support of this important bill. We all want to keep our students safe from sexual assault, and if one of our kids gets hurt, we want to make sure that they have the information and the support that they need to heal and move through that traumatic experience with strength. Well, House Bill 3476 helps us do that by providing a chance for survivors to get the confidential counseling they need without fear that the information could be used against them. I have a 13-year-old daughter, Julia, and as you know, I coach middle school debate team of young men and women. And one of the huge reasons why I do that is because I want to help those kids grow up strong and brave and resilient. And I think that we can not protect our kids from every tragedy or trauma that may happen to them in their lives, but we can give them the tools that they need to respond to trauma and tragedy and overcome it and heal. And I see this bill as an important step in doing that. This is a bill that will help ensure that our young people who experience a sexual assault can seek the counseling advice that they need in a confidential setting so that they can overcome their experience, respond to it, and heal. So we urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Springer, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sherry Springer, State Representative, House District 17 from SIO. And just one piece that I don't know that has been mentioned yet that I want to bring to this conversation. We're not talking about sexual assault being a wrong thing. We all know that. We're talking about the victims of sexual assault having a safe place to go to begin the process of healing, the process of reporting this. And something that strikes me, is just blows my mind when I think about it. Those of us in this building have a process of an intermediary. And you'll see the notes posted I don't know how many times around this building. There's four people during a legislative session whose names are on there. And if you feel that you have had less than a sexual assault, if you just feel like you have had somebody to create a harassing environment in your workplace, you have a safe, confidential person to go to. I happen to be one of those people in this building. But yet before now, before this bill, we're not providing that for our students when they've potentially been the victim of a crime. I think they deserve at least what we are provided in a workforce environment, at least the protections, the privacy, and the confidentiality that we get to enjoy. And I certainly encourage your support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Winters, please.
Thank you. Sorry, I'm late. You guys have me traveling all over the building today. I just, I just want to add my support to House Bill 3476, and I think you probably heard from the other members of this panel. We've met, we've discussed, we've talked about it, we've worked on it, and I have to say today I'm very proud to be here in this building, because this bill was not about a Democrat, not about a Republican. It was about all of us in this building. And also, you know, if you were out at the rally today, you would have seen, and thank you, some of our male colleagues who showed up to actually join us in this effort. You know, truly, for those of us who have been working on it, and those who have been involved in this whole issue of talking about sexual assaults and what's been going on in our, not only in our campuses, but throughout our communities. I think this is long overdue. And so I wanted to, you know, be here to join the other members that have been working with me on this very, very important bill.
Thank you, Senator. Attorney General, I hope you'll post your message online, or put that up, because that was some really great.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Chair, Mr. Chair. And if you have any questions, if not.
Questions from the panel, from the committee. For the
well,
panel.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Madam AG.
Yes.
You mentioned, and I probably will get this from your note, but you said Oregon is one of the few states that does not have this.
Yes, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, that is correct. There are 40 states that have some form of confidentiality privilege. There are 8 states that have a complete privilege, which is what we're asking for today. We would be the 9th.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Sybil Hebb. And just the next people on the on the on-deck circle is Carrie Morgan, or Morin, I'm sorry, Michelle Roland Schwartz, Jessica Amo, and Beltran are the next people.
Thank you, Chair Barker, Vice Chairs Williamson and Olson, and members of the committee. Thank you so much for your time here today, focusing on this incredibly important issue. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today in support of House Bill 3476. I'm also representing the interests of the Oregon Alliance to End Violence Against Women, and we wholeheartedly endorse this policy and welcome it as an important step forward for victims of domestic and sexual violence, both on campuses and in communities. As you know, the Oregon Law Center's mission is to help people who are low income and vulnerable escape the traps of poverty and to achieve access to justice. And what we have found is, in doing our work, a significant percentage of the issues that cause people to come into our offices looking for assistance is their desperation in trying to find the next steps forward in achieving safety after victimization by domestic or sexual violence. And this is a particularly important issue when you think about the impact on young people. College-age women, as you've heard before, are at heightened risk. It's one of the most dangerous times in their lives in terms of risk of this issue. And it's at a time when the trajectory of their lives and their educational aspirations ought to be really high, assault can really cause all of those hopes and dreams to plummet as people get trapped in this spiral of shame and doubt and fear. And having access to confidential services is the first step forward out of that spiral. And it's really, really critical. We know that it's very well established, and the witnesses before me testified well about how important it is to have confidential access to services and how important it is to be able to establish trust with someone to whom you're about to confide these horrible experiences, and to make sure that that information is not going to be taken and used without your permission and put into the broad spectrum. And that's critically important. Without a trust in the fact that that information will be protected and that your privacy will be protected, we know that victims just simply don't come forward. They don't come forward to get the help that they need and deserve. They also don't come forward to make reports and to allow or to have other administrative or criminal justice processes move forward. And so without having that first critical step of ensuring that there is confidentiality and that there is privacy, we can't provide people with the help that they need to recover. So this bill that we're proposing will solve that critical problem by providing that confidentiality and that reliability. I want to be clear that this concern exists on campuses as well as in communities. Right now, it is before us and is in really the forefront of many of our minds because of the critical issues that we're seeing on campuses across the nation. Unfortunately, that's not a new problem. It is newly in the news. But it is complicated newly by a federal law, which is being requires reporting of any kind, reporting and investigation through an administrative process on campuses anytime a person who is a responsible employee at a college or university or institution that's covered by Title IX, anytime a victim comes forward and makes a disclosure to someone who is a responsible employee, that information is automatically turned over to the investigative process, regardless of whether the victim chose to do that, wanted to do that, had any inclination or inkling that that was a possibility. And that is incredibly debilitating to victims. That threat can come up in non-campus situations as well, because there is no confidentiality or privilege protecting communications, even though there is also no requirement to trigger investigation responses. So our bill wants to make sure that we're addressing both of those circumstances. And the reason that we're doing this, of course, is that the violation of trust when there is information that's disclosed without the victim's permission is really just a re-victimization and a re-triggering of all of the trauma that existed in the first place. So to speak specifically to the campus situation for just a minute, I want to be clear that Title IX, while it requires the initiation of investigations when responsible employees have access to information, it does not disrespect state statutes that require confidentiality where those statutes exist. And so, for example, there are state statutes in Oregon that protect the confidentiality of communications with some individuals. Representative Springer mentioned some counselors, therapists, others have codified state statutes that protect confidentiality of communications. And most states, as was mentioned previously, 40 states, have statutes that provide some level of communication, confidentiality of communication for victim advocates. Oregon's not one of those states, and we don't have any statutes on those books. If we do, and if this law passes, then we will be allowed, and our campuses will be allowed, to maintain those confidences, and it will not be a violation of Title IX to maintain those confidences. And so to help our universities do the job that they want to do in providing confidential services, this bill is critically necessary, and it's also necessary to protect the good work that goes on in all of the domestic and sexual violence shelters and community-based programs. I'll take a quick, I guess the only other thing I would note is that federal law, the Office of Civil Rights of the Department of Education, the U.S. Department of Education, has issued significant guidance that was published in April of 2014 that acknowledges this dilemma and really encourages universities to establish people as confidential, and specifically acknowledges that where there are state statutes that do create this protection, that is sanctioned. So we have the blessing of people who of the federal authorities. I'll do a quick summary of the bill, and then I'm sure you're anxious to hear from the folks behind me who have daily experience in this issue and working in our communities across the state. So the bill in Sections 1 and 2 creates a privilege, an evidentiary privilege in Oregon's evidence code, and that would prohibit the disclosure of information without the victim's consent in administrative, civil, and criminal proceedings. Section 4 is sort of the corollary to that, which exists and creates as a standalone independent statute in our ORS code, a mandate that advocates maintain confidentiality and not disclose information without permission in other settings. So you can't tell your neighbor, you can't tell your family members, you can't tell the community. That is the confidentiality protection that exists in Section 4. And that's they're both critical to solving this problem for our communities and our universities. The bill protects the communications of victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. Those are the crimes that we're largely concerned about here, where there are those stigmas that attach and where the Title IX requirements apply. It protects the communications as well as records that advocates or victim services programs have. It requires that advocates have a consistent level of training in providing victim services that will be designated and provided specifically by the Attorney General by rule. And advocates, in order to be qualified for this confidentiality protection, must be employed by or volunteer with a non-governmental, nonprofit, community-based program providing services. And those programs must be specifically programs that are receiving funding from the Department of Justice or the Department of Human Services, so there's oversight of those programs, or they must be employed or volunteer with a campus-based victim services program. There are narrow exceptions that apply, but this provision is very solid and complete protection that is modeled on the best practices that exist in 8 other states in the nation, and we really hope that you will support it as it moves forward, because it will take Oregon in the right direction and just be a substantial step forward for victims in our communities. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Thank you. Okay, we'll call Carrie Moran, Michelle Roland Schwartz, Jessica, I think it's AMO, I can't tell, and BB Beltran. Next up would, on the in the batting circle is Carly Rohner, Marjorie Trueblood Gamble, and Brenda Tracy. And what we're going to do, well, because we have so many people, we're going to kind of limit you to 3 minutes, because we have a lot of people we need to get through, so we appreciate that. And you don't need, if somebody else has already said it, you don't need to say it again, but we want you to clearly have your voice heard here. So please go ahead and remember to identify yourself for the record.
Hey, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, and Vice Chair Williamson. My name is Carrie Moran Kuhn. I'm the Director of Programs for the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. There is a coalition in every one of the states in U.S. territories. Our coalition was founded in 1978, and our main task is supporting, providing training and technical assistance to the more than 50 programs across Oregon in their communities and on our tribal nations. House Bill 3476, as you have heard, will establish confidential communications between people seeking domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking services, and those victim service providers. Survivors often suffer in silence on campus or in their homes. Access to confidential services allows victims to come forward for help and support without fear of retribution or embarrassment. It is really important to notice that for survivors of domestic and sexual violence, confidentiality is about more than privacy. It's really also about safety. This bill allows survivors to come forward and discuss some of the most private and traumatizing events of their life with trained, certified advocates that will help them explore their options and who will help them plan for their safety. As you've heard, there's 40 other states that provide some sort of protections. We are really looking forward that this bill, which is based on best practice models, will provide stronger protections for Oregonians. With rights come responsibilities, and that is why the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence is already working closely with the Department of Justice to ensure certification of programs and advocates across the state. The large bipartisan support of House Bill 3476 is an indicator that domestic and sexual violence are truly nonpartisan issues. 3476 will help ensure victims can reach out for support in order to navigate a complex system and know their medical and legal options available to them. The Oregon Coalition Against Domestic Sexual Violence, Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, and our member programs, each of them, are deeply appreciative that you are considering this important legislation. You will be making a critical difference in the lives of survivors and of the advocates who are here to serve them across the state.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Roland Schwartz. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. We are a statewide nonprofit with multidisciplinary memberships that comprise over 100 Oregonians that serve on one of eight multidisciplinary subcommittees, and many of whom are here today in support of this bill. I am proud to be here with the co-chair of our campus subcommittee, Jessica Amo, who will speak in a moment, in support of House Bill 3476. Increasing victim access to confidential services by enacting victim advocate privilege is a priority for the task force this session. Immediately following a sexual assault, victims are faced with a lot of noise. Who should they talk to? Whether or not they should report? Concerns about what their friends, family, and partners may think? And fear of retribution from the systems that they may seek support from. Having advocate privilege helps mitigate and shut out that noise, helps mitigate their long-term trauma, and gives them a safe space whereby they can access accurate information about a sometimes intimidating process of medical, legal, and other support services. Victim advocates also help empower victims in their decision making. And we know that when victims are in control of their decisions and are empowered in their decisions, they're more likely to participate in critical services that increase their access to safety, health, and long-term path toward healing. We believe that House Bill 3476 will meaningfully address survivors' critical needs, and for this reason, we are here in full support of this bill. Thank you so much for your time.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Jessica Amo, and I'm the director of the PSU Women's Resource Center and co-chair of the Sexual Assault Task Force's campus subcommittee. I've spent the past 17 years working directly with survivors of sexual assault and relationship violence, and I'm in my seventh year of running a campus-based direct service advocacy program at Portland State University. And I'm also a responsible employee, as Sybil was describing. I'm a mandatory reporter. The core premise of my work is that students have a right to safely access their education, and sexual violence and relationship violence impede that access. While there are many things that our school can do and we do every day to address student safety, I find that students face a lot of barriers in deciding to make a report that would trigger interventions. Perhaps the biggest barrier is the fear of disclosure without consent, without the student's consent, or before they're ready. So I've had students tell me that they're really afraid of retaliation. They've described how their safety would be jeopardized. They're afraid of losing community and support by having a report move forward. The most critical step we can take to address these barriers is to give student survivors a safe, confidential place to work through their process and come to their own decisions about what action is right for them. My staff and I are committed to giving students a full range of service options and supporting them in making informed choices about how to move forward. However, without the protection of statutory privilege, we're limited in the conversations that student survivors can have with us. And when we don't fully know the issues that our survivors are facing, we can't really provide them comprehensive services. Students are more likely to decide to make a report or engage in services when they have access to a trusted support person. Currently, if a student accidentally forgets that we're not confidential and shares reportable information with us, we have to immediately make a mandatory report that may trigger an administrative process. This can damage our relationship with the student, put them at risk for re-traumatization, and potentially remove the student's autonomy at a time when it's critical that they retain control. Passage of this bill will allow advocates to offer fully confidential services, thereby increasing our capacity to support student safety. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Please. Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Bibi Beltran, and I'm the Executive Director of Sexual Assault Support Services, or SAS. SAS is a nonprofit organization that provides support and advocacy to survivors of sexual violence and abuse and their partners, friends, and family. Our service area is Lynn County, but we are located in the Eugene-Springfield area. So as you can imagine, a lot of our clients happen to be students. Privacy and confidentiality are vital to survivors of sexual violence, especially in tight-knit communities like college campuses and rural areas, which make up the bulk of Lynn County. violations to privacy and confidentiality have a ripple effect. They don't only impact the survivor, they impact the entire community. They create distrust and they make it so that survivors do not feel safe in accessing support that they desperately need. Sexual assault is never the survivor's fault. However, we live in a society which would suggest otherwise and oftentimes blames the victim. This message is internalized. Survivors struggle with guilt, shame, and they need somebody who is non-judgmental, who has confidentiality and privilege to support them, and so to ensure that they have as much information as possible to make the right decision for them. Privacy and confidentiality are necessary to provide survivors a safe space to explore their options in their own time. House Bill 3476 would provide those assurances of privacy and confidentiality that survivors need. If the Oregon legislature is serious about creating safer communities, being responsive to the needs of survivors, and reducing sexual violence, House Bill 3476 is an essential step in that process. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Perry Morin, Moran, Michelle, no, that's what we just did, all right? Carly Rohner, Marjorie Trueblood Gamble, and Brenda Tracy, please. Next up is Emma Calloway, Melinda Joy, and Ashley Jackson. You can just go ahead and start in any order you'd like, but please remember to identify yourself for the record.
Sure. Chair Barker and Vice Chair Olson and the members of the committee, my name is Marjorie Trueblood Gamble, and I serve as the Director of Diversity and Inclusion at Southern Oregon University. Within my role at SOU, I also serve as the Title IX Coordinator. The testimony that I give today comes from that lens. In our pursuit of addressing issues of sexual harassment and sexual violence, our goal should be twofold: supporting the survivors that come forward and addressing the systemic issues that are tied to this form of oppression. At my institution, we strive to be both compliant under Title IX and survivor-centered. We do this by designating a confidential advisor in addition to the confidential services that students can receive through our Student Health and Wellness Center. The confidential advisor provides substantial support to the victim in listening to them and providing them with a multitude of options. Our institution has designated that the confidential advisor be exempt to Title IX. By having this person in place, the victim can choose the steps in the process or slow the process down if need be. Their disclosure to this person is not an automatic Title IX report. Due to this designation, we are seeing our reporting numbers go up, which means that students are accessing resources that our campus can provide and feel safe in doing so. In fact, in 2011, we saw about 13 reports. For 2014, we're right around 50 reports. Historically, higher education institutions have been abdicating their responsibility to address sexual assault to places like the Women's Resource Center. The Dear Colleague letter from the Office of Civil Rights served as a reminder that administrations and administrators need to be confronting sexual violence as well. By no means should this take away the privacy that advocates have always provided in their support of survivors. In fact, through my role, the best way that I can support the victim is providing an equitable and unbiased process and to stop, prevent, and remedy these violations. I cannot act as an ally or a direct support person to the victims that come forward. Further, having a law granting a privilege status to advocates will serve to reaffirm the safe space and service that advocates have long provided. On our campus, our ultimate goal, or one of our goals, is campus safety. In order to do this, we need to receive more reports so that we can better address the problem. In addition, we must decrease reporting barriers to receive these reports. I believe that support of this bill provides more entry points for reports and better supports our victims. What I would like to see is that victims who have been traumatized through experiences of sexual assault can get the help that they need, but I also believe that this form of oppression has to be addressed systemically. While there might be tension between these two approaches, addressing both is paramount if we intend on affecting change. I believe the best way to meet the needs of the survivor on an individual level is through providing them with as many options, and this bill supports that need. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Brenda Tracy, and I am the survivor of a gang rape by four men. Two of them were Oregon State football players. And I'm here to support this bill, HB 3476, because I think that confidentiality and privacy is extremely important. I can't even stress to you how important it is. When you are raped, you have completely lost all sense of control. You have lost any type of sense of safety. You look at the world completely and totally differently. It's a trauma that completely warps your brain, your sense of everything that you thought was one way is no longer that way. And victims are good at blaming themselves. I was actually drugged, but I immediately blamed myself for drinking the drug to drink, if that makes any sense. I blamed myself for being raped because I went to that apartment, even though I knew the people there, they were my friends. But, you know, the crazy making starts right after the attack. And it's so important to be able to go to someone that not only knows about domestic violence and sexual assault, so they can understand my crazy making, and they can say to me, no, Brenda, it's not your fault that you drank the drink, you were drugged. And that is private, because it's so embarrassing. It's humiliating. And, you know, I subject myself to the public, and I put my story out there because there's so many people that felt like I did. For 16 years, I tried to hide this. I tried to disassociate it from it. I tried to pretend like it didn't happen. I tried to pretend like that movie that plays in my mind of four men raping me and high-fiving over my body was not me. But it was me. And there's so many more like me. And if you don't have privacy to talk about these things, then you have nothing. The victim has to have control. They have to feel like they're safe, and they have to feel like they're understood. HB 3476 does this for these people, men and women. And it's imperative that if we want to have people come forward on campuses and report and prosecute and get the help that they need, then it has to start here. If we don't start with this, we're not going to gain any traction on this issue, and nothing's going to get better. Thank you.
Thank you. And I would just like to say thank you very much for your testimony, and thank you for your being able to come out in front of the public like that. I'm sure you've saved a lot of girls in the future from being victims of this, because they have you to look up to, and they understand that something can be done.
Thank you. Really, if I could just add very quickly to that, you know, I really want to advocate for other victims. I want to tell women, yes, go to the school and report. But at the same time, I can't say to them, I don't know if it's going to be kept confidential.
Right.
That puts me in a bad situation. I want to be able to assure them report is the right thing to do. And this helps to do that.
So thank you very much.
I think that's important.
Please.
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, my name is Carly Rohner, and I'm the Director of Community Education over at Willamette University. My role in serving our students is through primary prevention programs, and this means that I create opportunities for our students to learn the skills necessary to identify high-risk precursors to violence in hopes that they'll assist us, the administrators, staff, and faculty, in reducing the amount of folks that are harmed within our community. The primary goal of violence prevention is to enable our college and university campuses to be spaces that are free of violence. The SAVE Act requires campuses to implement prevention programs that engage our students in understanding the dynamics of sexual and relationship violence and assist them in developing a role as active bystanders. As we help students to develop this ownership of their individual roles in violence prevention, myself and other practitioners around the state work alongside our students to do the following. Create environments where the norm is that violence isn't tolerated and that everyone is expected to do their part. to identify high-risk situations and to intervene if necessary and safe to do so, and to understand that the resources, or to understand resources available on campus to help both themselves and their friends should they need it. A direct effect of these forms of outreach, and especially the third item regarding resources, is that the more students are aware of and trust our resources, the more likely they are to access them. This trust is of key importance in this outreach. Prevention, by definition, is not reactionary, but good prevention efforts cannot exist in spaces where victims of violence don't feel supported or are fearful of the consequences of sharing their story. How we assist victims after violence has occurred directly impacts how truthful they and their peers believe our prevention messages to be. As we continue to provide outreach and prevention programs with the message that we care about our campus community, and therefore we care about reducing violence in the form of sexual and relationship violence, we must simultaneously demonstrate that we're willing not just to focus on prevention, but to also continue supporting those who have been or may be harmed in the future. By creating environments where survivors and the peers that support them can be given accurate and timely information in a confidential manner, it not only supports victims seeking recovery, it validates our messages of prevention as well. It ensures students that while we as practitioners will do our best to ensure that their collegiate experience and that the collegiate environment is safe, that we will support them or if or when their lives intersect with sexual or relationship violence, and that those who support them will be able to do so in a competent and confidential manner. Metaphorically, prevention and response are two sides of the same coin. Each must equally be strong in order to best serve our students and their needs. This is why HB 3476 is so critically important to the continuation of our prevention efforts here in Oregon. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I welcome any questions that you have.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It takes me a while to process, especially something as huge as this. And so my question may be, I should have gone back to the first panel, the Attorney General or Representative Williamson or Springer, but because you said prevention, it triggered something in my head. Do you see this as a prevention tool almost? Because this is great. I'm with everybody on this. But I want to almost broaden it in a way or somehow. How do I put a sign up that says, look, you know, we'll be reported now. And I don't know if this would have prevented what happened to you. I want it to. I want it, the prevention part to be a part of this. And does that make sense? Am I asking a question?
Yeah.
I'm doing it again, aren't
I?
I do this all the time. I sort of just talk, and there's a question somewhere in there. I'm sorry. But
absolutely. And I'd love to yield for a second, and then I can come back and answer if that's okay.
Well, I think that when you create an environment on a campus where it's safe to report, the more people come forward and report and pretty much say, like, this is not going to happen, we're going to report, it's going to prevent. I mean, people are going to think twice about some of the behavior and what they're doing if they know for a fact that somebody's going to report, because a lot of people do things because they think they can get away with it. And if that's been what's been happening, why do we have to change? So I definitely think it has an effect.
Absolutely. And to add to that, it's a cycle. And I think one of the things that first point I mentioned about creating a community where the norm is that violence isn't tolerated, if we have spaces where folks feel like they can come forward and report and that accountability is held within that community, absolutely. I think that's a preventative major.
Yeah, you've got to shift the shame from the victim to the perpetrators.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool. Thank you.
Hmm. Sure, Mr. Chair. Representative Post, there used to be an old saying when we used to do training in law enforcement, if it's predictable, it's preventable. Mm-hmm. And that's actually what they're capturing.
Okay. Thank you very much, panel. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Emma Calloway, Melinda Joy, and Ashley Jackson. Next up is Todd Blatzell and Carrie Hall. I think that's a. And Chris Allman.
Great.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Emma Calloway. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Student Association. We started a process about 2 years ago of surveying 30,000 students across 15 college campuses, one piece of paper at a time, to ask them what their most important issues were. And sexual assault prevention was one of the top three issues on every campus across all demographics. And we very much believe that this bill is an opportunity to do something very important. I would also like an opportunity to share with you that I'm a person that would have been impacted by this bill while I was in college. I know what it feels like to be physically overpowered, to have my choices taken away, and then to have no place to turn on campus because I was an RA at the time and I knew that my story would have been immediately reported and I knew this person, and that was not the process that I wanted to go through. Advocacy privilege would have meant that I would have had the choice to learn about all of the resources that would have been available to me without taking a mandatory reporting process that felt like a criminal proceeding, and that's not something that I would have wanted. This bill isn't about demonizing our institutions. It's about giving students a choice. There's also a message on the record from the Oregon University System and the Alliance of Public Colleges in support of this bill. I will say that we believe that we can go one step further, and Representative Post, there is another bill that deals specifically with resources on college campuses, and we believe that there's a lot of work that can be done in that arena. Today we have two amazing students that's going to share their stories with you. There are also 15 students in the gallery downstairs that wanted to be here today during spring break because they believe this issue is very important, as do I. So as the executive director of the Oregon Student Association and someone that absolutely believes that this bill is the right thing to do, myself and our 120,000 members across the state of Oregon ask you to vote yes on this bill. Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Melinda Joy, and I'm from Coos Bay, Oregon. I'm here testifying to support HB 3476. I'm the youngest of seven children, and I, like all of my siblings before me, began life solely dependent upon the various extended family's members' generosity. Eventually, I, too, was placed in foster care system and was made a ward of the state. Today, I'm a student at Portland State University. I'm graduating this spring with a double major in community health and health sciences. I went to college because, as I hope you can imagine, I appreciate stability. I want to contribute to society in a meaningful way, and more importantly, I want to have a job that can support me. College gives me the opportunity to overcome my limitations and not to have to live a life that, frankly speaking, is unstable, frustrating, and insecure. While receiving my degree shortly before transferring to Portland State University, I was sexually assaulted. The event itself was unforgivable, but more pressing issue was coping with its effects it left on me. I had a life and I wasn't about to stop living it. When I transferred to PSU, I was hopeful to be at a school with a health center that provided counseling services on campus. With my classes figured out, I sought out what services I could find. I didn't know where to start, and I didn't expect to find difficulty in finding resources. I was waitlisted for a support group in the community, and I was hoping to get counseling services on campus. The first available appointment, simply to evaluate what services they could offer me, was a month away. I made it all more difficult as I tried to navigate the resources without saying something to the wrong person and reporting information that I wasn't intending to. Reporting is a long and in-depth process. I didn't want to start that process until I felt secure in my day-to-day reality. The threat of mandatory reporting and not knowing who I could trust only added to my anxiety as I tried to find resources. I was struggling to make it through my classes without the support I needed. I don't have a family support as a safety net, but I knew that these services were offered and supposed to be there, and that there had to be something that the school could do to help me. After my evaluation, my psychologist explained that I was complicated, that they weren't equipped to handle anything more than a 10 to 12 week transitional depression, things that college students suffer from, except, I guess, for sexual assault. They were unable to help me, and their solution was to refer me out to community providers, which I had to find myself. With midterm starting, it was difficult to make much progress. I approached the Women's Resource Center with some hesitation. I had not reported my experience yet, and I was cautious of talking with anyone who might escalate my situation. I wasn't ready to report or for the process that I involved.
When I asked for resources for survivors, they pointed me towards a wall of brochures, and they explained to me that they had what they called an interpersonal violence coordinator, but that position seemed more like a domestic issue and was not what I was looking for. I was also worried that the IPV coordinator might report my issue or get others involved. I continued my search for campus resources, including the Disability Resource Center and the Dean's Office, but was unsuccessful. After classes ended for the year, I found the resources that I needed, and I'm currently doing well. But my first year was hell. I alternated between crippling anxiety, depression, and the overwhelming desire to give up. I forced myself to put on a smile after I contemplated the life that I might lead without college. I was frustrated because every time I tried to talk to someone about my situation, they simply told me that maybe I needed to take a break, not realizing that that is not an option or a luxury that I have. People always talk about the system getting taken advantage of, but rarely consider what might happen if the state doesn't come through on its part. Throughout the chaos of navigating the process, my life was not on hold. I held it together through force of will and the knowledge that I had nowhere to land without a college degree. I'm not asking for much control over my option to report when and how I feel like it. The ability to receive resources schools are already asked to provide. I urge you to pass HB 3476 so I don't have to ask again. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Ashley Jackson, and I'm a student from Eugene, Oregon. House Bill 3476 would accomplish something that is long overdue for Oregonians when involved with sexual assault. Those that have experienced sexual assault know very well the emotional impact that is replicated every time that you have to retell your story, and that within our institutions that demand a specific story and specific words to describe that story in a memory that is very chaotic. This often prevents filing from ever happening, from reports ever being filed. This bill would empower victims to move past survivorhood into a state of healing directed by them in a way they choose, when they choose, all the while allowing themselves to plant them within the community that they have grown to trust. The first hours after a traumatic event, you're acutely aware of certain things that have happened, and you're numb to other parts, in particular some of the worst parts of what has happened to you. A story I'd like to share with you is about my peer, who isn't here today, but who has agreed to let me share this story in an anonymous way for her. She was sexually assaulted in a music room at our school, which is very quiet, secluded, and soundproof. While she didn't realize the repercussions of seeking help on campus, her outreach and her trying to access resources triggered an administrative response that consequently put her in a dangerous situation, and she wasn't able to finish out the term. She had to stop going to her classes because it wasn't a response that was unique to her situation. It was a cookie cutter response that left her safety off to the side. I know from firsthand experience that making these kind of reports, especially to law enforcement, are extremely traumatic, and they can result in false narratives, especially if they're done prematurely. House Bill 3476 will allow our schools to support students and to assist in their search for justice. Recovery and justice isn't a linear process, and we deserve the right to be able to talk to people and to choose to talk to people who we trust on campus without fear that law enforcement or campus safety is going to get involved. The best advocates for people who have been sexually assaulted are themselves. People should be empowered to trust their instinct and their intuition, and they should be empowered to access resources that are available and waiting for them on campus. And they should be able to do that in whichever order they decide. I believe that this legislation will empower people to teach and learn skills such as self-care, accessing resources, and establishing meaningful relationships within the community. I would expect to see an increase in reports if this bill passed. And I would expect to not just see an increase in reports, but to see an increase in the quality and the outcome of those reports. It's not fair to subject a survivor to someone else's agenda or job requirements or interpretation of their experience. I don't really think that there's any way that you can fully bring justice to a situation like sexual assault, but there is an inner power that is found within the victims that choose to become survivors and take healing into their own hands for their families, themselves, and within their communities. I think about my own story from time to time and how traumatic that was, but how more traumatic it was to have choices made for me. And I believe that our campuses are better than that. I believe that we can make our campuses a learning experience, a learning environment for this experience for both parties involved, or however many parties involved. And at the very least, I think we will be able to talk about what we need before we take any administrative or legal action. Please, I ask you as a student, Oregonian, a sister, a mother, and a daughter, that this privilege be granted to the people that have been denied already the right to safety and well-being by another person, and to start helping this generation of students become skilled at accessing resources and be taking part in advocacy in our communities. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. And I also hope, I know with the confidentiality it'd be somewhat difficult, but if the predators are being identified with multiple victims, I hope that we can do something about that and get them out there. Representative Leininger.
You know, I know that it's a terrible set of facts that brings us all here, the need for this bill, but I have to say that, you know, seeing wave upon wave of strong advocates come and tell your stories, it's really powerful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, next I'll call Todd Blatzel, Carrie Hall, and Chris Allman. Next up would be Gail Meyer. Okay. And if Gail shows, Gail, she's, I believe Gail's downstairs. But she can sit up front when she gets here.
Chair Baker and members of the House Judiciary Committee, my name is Todd Baltzell, and I'm with the Newburgh-Dundee Police Department, and also on behalf of the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, we're asking that you pass this bill. I've been in law enforcement for over 21 years, and the vast majority of that was investigating person crimes, which involve sexual assault, interpersonal violence, and those types of investigations. And the more I worked these cases and the more experience I gained, the more I realized that although the criminal justice system is important in the arena of sexual assault, it's not the most important, which is hard because I'm a police officer. Sexual assault oftentimes breaks the soul of its survivors. Apprehending and convicting the offender only affects part of the victim's recovery in this. And when a survivor is not ready to engage in the criminal justice system, it can do as much damage to that victim as a sexual assault itself. Survivors need a safe place to interact with the true experts of the field in the arena of sexual assault without fear of being compromised or thrust into a world that they're not ready for. We need to remember that only between 2% and 4% of people who have been sexually assaulted actually make a report to law enforcement. And the CDC shows that 1 out of every 4 Oregon women have been a victim of sexual assault. We need to recognize the offenders are creating a society of broken victims, and inadvertently, the criminal justice system is exacerbating that abuse. I truly believe that if our victims have a safe place to go to begin to heal and to gain strength, we will see the number of sexual assault reports go up. Stronger victims equal stronger cases. I truly believe this bill is in a step in the right direction.
Thank you. Please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Carrie Hole, and I'm the program director for the You Have Options program and a detective at the Ashland Police Department. Created by law enforcement for the benefit of law enforcement and victims alike, the You Have Options program focuses on changing two key areas in the criminal justice response to sexual violence, increasing the number of reports that we receive from sexual assault survivors, and identifying sexual assault offenders for serial perpetration. The You Have Options program is a national program available to any sworn law enforcement agency that recognizes the need for a victim-centered and offender-focused response that is outlined within the program's 20 elements. A crucial foundation for this program, both during development and ongoing national implementation, is meaningful and informed collaboration between law enforcement and victim advocacy. During the development of the You Have Options program, the Ashland Police Department realized that the astoundingly low rate of reporting to law enforcement by victims of gender violence was an indication of a victim's mistrust of the criminal justice system. In other words, traditional methods of investigating these crimes were actually contributing to an environment that kept victims from feeling safe enough to report the details of their victimization as they were able to remember them. Traditional law enforcement response to sexual violence tends to discourage sexual assault victims from seeking assistance through the system. As a result, law enforcement often does not receive the information necessary to hold sexual offenders accountable, allowing those offenders to go on and victimize additional persons. In an attempt to move away from this traditional law enforcement response, investigators initiated conversations with sexual assault advocates and other experts in the field of sexual assault investigation, response, and prevention. Victims who did report were asked for their assistance in identifying ways that the police department could bring positive change to the reporting process and any subsequent investigation. Almost every victim that investigators involved with the development of this program spoke with mentioned the same concern: fear of not being believed. Realizing that this was overwhelmingly one of the most common barriers to reporting a gender violence crime to law enforcement, we determined that one of the ways this barrier could be addressed was by offering victims the opportunity to first meet with a confidential advocate who was well educated on the criminal justice options available. I highlight the word confidential in there. That has been the key to our program's success. I stress this importance of true confidentiality because providing survivors with a safe, supportive system for entering the criminal justice process has made all the difference. We have found that when victims are given the time they need to make the decision that is right for them, independent of any need or want of the criminal justice system, they will often still choose to meet in some capacity with law enforcement and provide information on criminal activity within that law enforcement's jurisdiction or other jurisdictions in other communities. This first step is very integral to law enforcement finally being able to make meaningful change in their response to sexual violence. I continue to see the benefit to the criminal justice system when a victim has access to a confidential person that is solely there for them. Victims often, understandably, have inaccurate information about the criminal justice process and are often more willing to share their confusion and concerns with a person not affiliated with law enforcement. This is common sense. This is the reality of how these crimes occur. Many victims do not have access to legal advice and may only be able to obtain assistance, including important safety information, from advocacy. House Bill 3476 offers the option to strengthen this important component by clearly defining advocate privilege and by allowing an advocate to reassure a victim that what was told to them in confidence, as options are explored and concerns are voiced, will remain confidential. The importance of this additional reassurance to victims seeking help cannot be overstated. As a detective, I have personally worked with many sexual assault survivors who told me during the course of a criminal investigation that they did not believe they ever would have reported their experience to law enforcement without first having the option to meet confidentially with an advocate. One such survivor told me, "I wasn't sure in the beginning if I could go to trial, but you still put in the effort and now he's in prison. I would never have worked with the police without this program." Important to note in that comment is that this survivor would likely never have come to see me at all without first learning of her options in a confidential capacity with an advocate. For these reasons, passage of House Bill 3476 is supported by the You Have Options program. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Do you have any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gail, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We want to thank the sponsors of this bill, and we specifically want to thank Sybil Hebb and Aaron Knott from the Department of Justice. They reached out to OCDLA even before the session began and previewed the bill concept with us. Our committee looked at it and studied it and asked the two of them to address the committee, which they came and did. And as a result of that in-depth analysis, I'm pleased to say that OCDLA is neutral on the bill and has absolutely no problems at all with this bill passing as it does. And I would like to just briefly forecast for the committee the bigger context within which we see this bill. Next week, you will have another bill in front of you that will eliminate the statute of limitations for sex assaults, even against adults. And in our view, we do think it's critical that all policy be directed towards promoting prompt reports of sex assaults. We need good evidence in a court of law. The courtroom has a lot of inherent strengths, and our system is a good system, but it has weaknesses that get exacerbated the further away from event anything is adjudicated. So in the world of the criminal defense attorney, what we believe is that good public policy promotes prompt reporting. And I love what one of the prior witnesses said. She said that she thinks that this bill will help this generation of students become skilled at coming forward and promptly reporting. It's our hope that all policies be directed towards just that. And so we thank the sponsors and we thank the committee. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So the bill is not ready to move today with paperwork and so on, so we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3476. Thank you. Next, we'll open a hearing on House Bill 2776 and call Representative Parrish and Representative Taylor.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2776 comes to us from Representatives Parrish and Taylor. The bill allows a peace officer to apply to a circuit court judge for an ex parte emergency protective order. It provides that the court may enter such an order if the court finds probable cause to believe that an officer has responded to a domestic disturbance which requires a mandatory arrest, the person is in immediate danger of further abuse by a family or household member, and an emergency protective order is necessary to prevent the person from suffering further abuse. An emergency protective order expires 5 days after entry. Lastly, House Bill 2776 provides that violation of an emergency protective order constitutes contempt of court. There are no amendments before the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, Julie Parrish, state rep from House District 37. Westland and Tualatin, we're bringing you House Bill 2776 today for your consideration. This bill was actually brought to us by the chief of police in Lake Oswego, who has come from another state where they are actively doing this and with no issues in terms of helping somebody who's a victim of domestic violence or somebody who is in an emergently threatening situation. The ability to have a reprieve through a temporary protective order. So this bill actually, and there will be a dash one amendment. So we've worked with some folks who've brought up some concerns. We've worked to address those concerns. So you will see a consensus. What I hope is a consensus amendment will be coming forward to address some of the language in the bill that wasn't itself clear. Specifically, a couple of the items that you'll see in the amendment, looking at 7 days, it says 5 judicial business days. That sounds really wonky. We know that, particularly for those of you who've served in law enforcement, that somebody who is going to put somebody else in harm's way does not do that during the hours of 8 to 5, Monday through Friday. So we want to make sure that somebody who, frankly, you know, gets the hell beat out of them on a Thursday night has enough time to recuperate, get their wits about them, and actually go in and take this temporary order, move it forward. The following week and hopefully turn it into something that is a more lasting protective order and sees it as a tool to get out of a bad situation. We know that if a situation comes up and somebody's in a domestic violence situation or abusive situation, that sometimes particularly women don't take that step. So if you have an incident over the weekend, you get around a Monday, Tuesday, we don't make that first step to go out and and leave an abuser or seek the support. This actually puts something in their hand that I think gives them a pathway to go and seek out those services. You're going to hear from quite a few more people behind us who are much more wise on the subject, some of our law enforcement friends, some of our folks from Clackamas Women's Services who are dealing with this every day as part of the work that they do. So we're just excited to bring you the bill. I'm going to let Rep. Taylor speak. We just came out of committee, so sorry. We're just...
We're waiting for you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Kathleen Taylor, State Representative, House District 41, which encompasses Milwaukee, Oak Grove, and parts of Southeast Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today about House Bill 2776, which establishes temporary emergency protective orders for victims of domestic violence. And, of course, thank you to Representative Parrish for her work on this issue as well. Every legislator received yesterday received an email from the report from the Oregon Domestic Violence Fatality Review Team and their recommendations. First on the list of the recommendations to improve the safety provided by restraining orders is enhancing an emergency protection order law like the one we are dealing with today. It provides law enforcement with the capacity to seek an immediate, temporary, non-contact order from a judge on a 24-hour basis. We had a group of technical experts help craft the Dash 1 amendment, which you'll have. Law enforcement helped make sure the mechanics of this process would work statewide. We also had input from domestic violence prevention advocates and defense attorneys. I'll let the experts speak specifically to the provisions of the bill in just a moment here. But I did want to highlight a few shocking statistics. I like to take these opportunities to just reiterate how serious of an issue we have here regarding domestic violence. So 9%, about 78,000 of Oregon women reported being physically assaulted by an intimate partner in the last 5 years. During just one day in September 2013, 1,187 victims were served by local domestic violence programs in Oregon. And in 2013, Oregon had 24 fatal domestic violence incidences, and in 2014, that number was 28. Domestic violence has tragic results. And just to be clear, it's not only the persons involved in the altercation that are at risk. Children, other family members, and law enforcement officers are obviously also endangered. Let's all remember Officer Robert Lipke, who was fatally shot in November 2013 while responding to a domestic violence situation. House Bill 2776 is just one small but necessary tool to help better protect the victims of domestic violence. It has the support of both the domestic violence and law enforcement communities, and I urge your support for House Bill 2776.
Thank you. Any questions for the representatives? Thank you very much, Rebecca.
I'm just going to add one quick other thing. So we also, one of the other things that you'll see in the Dash 1 amendment is we do seek to clarify that it is issuing one of these orders, and again, these are very narrow in their scope. They don't deal with custody issues. They don't deal with checkbook issues. They are simply a cooling off tool to get somebody out of an emergent situation, but it is consent driven. So we envision this being where a law enforcement officer, you know, says, hey, this tool is available. Would you like us to issue one of these on your behalf? They would not do it without the victim's consent. So we think that that's really important. That was one of the issues that got brought up, because in the original draft, the bill was written was silent on that. So we think that that strengthens, the Dash 1 will strengthen this bill, and we will leave it, like I said, to the experts to
get you the rest of the information. Thank you for extra work on that, too.
Thank you.
Melissa Earlbaum, Dan Johnson, Rachel Sowery, and I think Sybil could come up again, too, if you'd want to, with their four seats.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. I'm Don Johnson. I come to you with 35 years of law enforcement behind me from three different law enforcement agencies, a chief for the last 15 years in those three agencies. One of the things that I committed to a long time ago in law enforcement was to protect victims' rights. And one of the most vulnerable populations that we serve are victims of domestic violence. What I've seen anecdotally and through my years of experience is that it's not the first act of domestic violence that we're usually involved with. There's usually a pattern that's gone on before the police are called. So this bill, which I urge your support for wholeheartedly, and the Oregon Chiefs of Police do also, take some of the complication out of gaining a restraining order. Right now, a victim in the state of Oregon has to navigate the court system during court hours. And that's right on top of being victimized, being traumatized, and trying to deal with just basic necessities of life. So this kind of takes it out of their hands, lets them have an opportunity to gain that footing before they have to start dealing with the court issues. In Oregon, the mandatory arrest statutes are clear in 107 of the Oregon Revised Statutes. But one of the things they don't do is reach deep enough. This bill, if accepted, deals with circumstances when the officer encounters the elements of the crime exist, the victim believes they're in danger, but the arrest is not mandated. So we've got harassment, to name one that would possibly fall under there, reckless endangering another. Also, circumstances when the officer reasonably believes that the physical danger is there for the victim, but there's no probable cause for arrest. We can offer it to them in that particular situation. One of the other parts that this closes, the gap that it closes, is in elder abuse situations where physical abuse is taking place at the hands of a family member that might suffer mental incapacity, and there's no probable cause for arrest there again. So I would really urge your support and look forward to hearing.
Thank you, Chief.
Hi, my name is Melissa Erlbaum. I'm the Executive Director for Clackamas Women's Services and a resident in Clackamas County. And I want to thank Chair Barker and all the members of this committee for all the work that you're doing on these issues around domestic and sexual violence. It's really critically important work, and we deeply appreciate it. I'm here to support House Bill 2776 because it's the right thing to do for survivors. So often, in fact, very recently when we were opening the Family Justice Center in Clackamas County, we did a study on how many stops a domestic violence survivor had to make in order to seek just basic safety resources. And it was up to and often close to 13 stops within a 48-hour period in order to get shelter, get a restraining order, medical assistance, meet with an advocate. The emergency protection order would help with that so that a survivor doesn't have to worry the next morning about how they're going to get that protection order. It gives them a time to talk with an advocate, get the medical support they need, and deal with these issues. I also wanted to point out that as a community-based nonprofit, we spent a lot of our resources providing hotel vouchers and other immediate safety needs for survivors that an emergency protective order could assist with. So if an emergency protective order can provide that safety in someone's home, which is a far better situation for them than having to enter a shelter or a hotel in the middle of the night, this is the right thing to do for survivors. So we strongly urge you to support this. We think it will prevent future homicides. We think it will prevent violence from increasing in many situations, and it will provide a great safety net for survivors. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Rachel Sowray. I am representing ODAA today. I am a deputy district attorney in Washington County, Oregon. I have been working there for about 5.5 years, and much of my time there has been devoted to working on domestic violence victims, with domestic violence victims, as well as on those cases. These issues are very important to me personally. And I'm here to say that we are supporting this bill at ODAA. It's an important tool. Restraining order is something that prevents violence. It creates more safety in many situations, and this is just another way to advance that opportunity to victims, to families, and hopefully for the community as a whole. And everything that everybody else has said is certainly very true, and we hope that this bill is supported. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, Vice Chairs and members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today, again, also in support of House Bill 2776. I echo the comments of those that went before me, and I would just add that in our experience at Legal Aid, working with petitioners, even if we're helping them go through the process as their attorney, most courts require you to come at some point during the morning, 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock, you fill out the paperwork, and then you come back later in the day to have your time in front of the judge. It's a lot of time, and so it is a great burden to remove from the survivor if there can be an immediate order put into place at the scene of the crime or the scene of the police response. And the other thing is, having worked in a rural office where I first began practice, we would often get calls from victims, 3 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, and there's just no hope for them until Monday, and they can't can't get, they're not close enough to the courthouse, they've already missed the time. And so this really helps to address that gap where the court's not available to them during the normal open hours, but a law enforcement officer can help them get that order put into place. I would just offer also that I appreciate the efforts of Chief Johnson and others who reached out to talk with us about this bill back when they were first starting to draft it. And we appreciated that input and had some conversations recently that also included outreach to, although Ms. Meyer wasn't able to attend the meeting, we were in conversations. We have some technical amendments that I think everybody agreed to that we hope are consensus. We haven't seen that language back yet, but we will be sharing it and navigating that, and I think that could move forward with all of us, hopefully, is the goal. The other issue that I would just add briefly is that the bill, I think, I would just point out that the order, once it is entered, it's just a no-contact order. It doesn't include any of the other forms of relief that are available through a restraining order process where you do have your full audience in front of the judge. And this order expires on its own terms after a certain period, and a very short period. So it's really just meant to be kind of a quick emergency stay-away order that gives the victim that critical time that they need to get into moving on to their next steps. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And I'm assuming that the other person needs to be there in order to be served.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, the order, of course, would not take effect until the order had been served. So, yes.
Couple questions.
Yes, sure.
Okay, so, Sybil, or maybe Chief Johnson, you can walk through this with me a little bit. Because I got to tell you, I know, Sybil, you just said you'd like to do this in a quick manner, you know, for at the domestic violence incident they're seeing. But I think this is almost a little bit cumbersome, to be truthful with you, because let's say, you know, Chief Johnson, you have two of your officers respond to an incident 2:00 Sunday morning. And so individual gets arrested for assault second, well, I'll say assault 3, okay, because the kids were present. They are going to have to pursue getting a what I see a court. Well, actually, let's see here. Let me walk through this really quick. A protective order by the court. Then they serve that on the respondent. I get that. That's going to be easy to do because he's going to be in custody. But then you prepare an affidavit at the same time for proof of service, and then following that, you have to also access LEDs to enter that. So all those things have got to happen before that individual gets out Monday morning. So I'm seeing this almost being a little bit cumbersome, but I'm just curious your thoughts on that.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I think that some of those questions are going to be resolved through the amendments. There were a number of issues related to the affidavits, the recording, the service, and the details around expiration. and so the folks who came up with the amendments were largely represented by the chief, also the sheriffs, and there was someone from the District Attorney's Association, Dinah Vitalin's there. So they all know a lot more than I about sort of how those mechanics work, and I believe that's what the amendments are designed to address.
Okay, thank you.
And
thank you.
If I may,
oh, yes,
Chair Barker and members, this process has been in place, I think it's in 29 states across the nation now, a similar process. We took a real thoughtful look at a lot of those models and came up with the best practices. I was using this process in the state of California for about the last 17 years, I believe, and it actually streamlines things, doesn't make it more cumbersome. There are things you have to do to get into the LED system. There are things you have to do to make sure that the paper flows correctly, but it puts immediate protection in for the victim, and that was the main point of legislation sweeping the country.
Thank you, Representative
Springer. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to follow up on a little bit of what Representative Olson was talking about, and probably mostly for you, Chief, just some pragmatic pieces of this. My first question was, what about the service? Would the service of the paper to the defendant be as simple as a copy? Coming from a county background, civil service is a really big deal. as far as the paperwork. So is that going to be in a manageable piece? And how has that occurred maybe in California?
California, it's a triplicate form. We talked about that in the committee and came up with the same conclusion that that would be one to the victim, one to the police agency for entry into LEDS, and one to the on the suspect when that you find the suspect.
Paul, so I think you answered then the question I was going to have. You asked, you used the example that they're in jail getting processed, but this allows for a protective order to be issued, and they, in the event there is not an arrest.
Correct. It fills the gaps where that there's not an arrest or where there's not probable cause for an arrest.
So then my last question is, as I read in Section 1 here, it lists the criteria under which the order can be issued. Knowing the unpredictability oftentimes of a victim, even to the point, don't arrest him, he's wonderful, I don't want him to go to jail, do you envision, because I couldn't see this defined, always issuing that protective order, that 5 judicial day, or issuing it if it's asked for, or issuing it if the officer thinks so? Because the beauty of the mandatory arrest law years back was you don't have to ferret through, the argument's gotten better, or they're okay again, and she doesn't want the provider of the family to go to jail. How does this fit into that paradigm, the trigger at which this is issued?
In the
did
the
that
group,
make sense?
It did. In the work group that we were able to discuss with Chair Barker and members, they're not offered in every case. They're offered based on the experience that the officer might have, based on the severity of the case, and based on what it looks like the victim needs. In other states and in other practices, there it's a mandatory that you will offer the victim in each and every case. And we looked at it and said, for our community here in Oregon, we'd like to make an offering of that order when that the officer believes that there's cause, that they may be in physical or imminent danger down the road after the officer leaves and after the person isn't arrested for that mandatory arrest crime, or even when they are arrested for a mandatory arrest crime. Right now, the stay away orders, if one is issued on a domestic violence victim in Clackamas County, Lake Oswego doesn't know that. It's not entered into a LEDS system, and that's kind of the way it is across the state, and this would help change that too.
Could I follow up? Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not necessarily advocating one way or the other. I think that this is an important piece that needs some serious discussion. The reason for the mandatory arrest law years ago was simply if the officer had, this terrible thing would not have occurred, and the liability issue of that. Yet you don't necessarily want to serve paper on somebody, and nobody involved wants that paper. So I would see two issues to that. Number one, the trigger, if it's mandatory or not to be issued, and if it was to be a mandatory service, if the criteria existed, then the second piece to that would be, can that 5-day judicial cooling off period be rescinded if both parties agree? And I don't have the answers to those, but I think those are questions that deserve answers.
And Chair Barker, Representative Springer, and members, the only thing I would offer is that in the discussions that we had that resulted in a request for amendments, the group decided that the clarification they would like around that piece was to leave the discretion to the allow the officer, make it permissive so that the officer might offer this relief to the victim, but that it be preconditioned on the victim's consent or permission to move forward with that request, knowing that in some cases that can lead to escalation and that it's important to involve the victim in that decision. So I think that, and I think that was important to some of the members of the folks that got together. So I think that'll be addressed, and there'll be a little bit more specificity. I mean, I get at your whole question, but that we expect to have some language on that in the amendments coming forward. So thank you.
Chief Johnson, I just want to thank you as the chief of police of my town. I want to thank you for the ideas and the goodwill and the strong commitment to safe families and victims' rights in our community. It's really wonderful to be working with you. So, and thank you to everyone on the panel for and the representatives who brought this bill. It's an important piece of legislation, so thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, panel. Aaron Greenewald and Gail Meyer, please. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker, and members of the committee. My name is Erin Greenewald, and I am an attorney with the Oregon Department of Justice. Specifically, I'm the Domestic Violence Resource Prosecutor for the Oregon Department of Justice. But I really am here not only on behalf of the Department of Justice, but also as the co-chair of the statewide Oregon Domestic Violence Fatality Review Team to urge your support of House Bill 2776. As you heard Representative Taylor mention, those of you sitting in front of me today should have received the report that I sent out yesterday on improving the efficacy of our restraining order process in Oregon. And as she mentioned, one of the recommendations that we made was to pass an emergency protection order law. Just a bit of background, the Domestic Violence Fatality Review Team was initially codified in 2005, but it wasn't until 2011 where we really got going in our work, and we began to review, in-depth review of domestic violence fatality reviews, cases rather, in 2012. And since then, we have done four, and we're going to do a fifth early next month. And the purpose of doing those fatality reviews is to look at the individuals involved in those cases from their birth until their death or incarceration, not just the incident, to see where along the line the system could have intervened. And so, as I think Representative Springer just said, but for something happening, or if something had happened, could a different outcome have happened? Could we have prevented something from happening? And in looking at least one, if not two, of the cases that we've seen, we felt like if there had been an emergency protection order process, then perhaps a different outcome could have resulted. Perhaps a death could have been prevented. So that's why it was included in the first of four mini reports that the legislature is going to receive. So I would echo the comments made by the panel before me, and I would urge your support of this very important bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you. Okay, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2776, and I'm going to open a public hearing on two more bills at the same time, House Bill 3466 and 3469, and again, Rachel Salary and Gail Meyer.
It's actually 3476.
I'm sorry, 3476.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 3476 comes to us from a variety of members. 66. We were right on 66, yeah. House Bill 3466 comes to us from Representative Williamson. The bill states that release criteria for a defendant charged with a sex crime or a crime constituting domestic violence must include a prohibition on contact or attempted contact with the victim, either directly or through a third party. The bill provides that when a defendant is charged with a sex crime or a crime involving domestic violence, the court must enter an order prohibiting contact or attempted contact with the victim, either directly or through a third party, while the defendant is in custody. We have proposed -1 and -2 amendments in front of us that state this prohibition does not apply to a defense attorney or the defense attorney's agent. House Bill 3469 comes to us from Representative Williamson as well. The bill increases the penalty for the crime of strangulation if the defendant knows the victim is pregnant. House Bill 3469 makes such conduct a Class C felony with a maximum punishment of 5 years imprisonment, $125,000 fine, or both. The bill additionally expands the types of previous convictions that elevate assault in the fourth degree from a Class A misdemeanor to a Class C felony. There are no amendments before the committee.
Okay, thank you. So Rachel Salary and Gail Meyer could both come up. Gail, you can come up too if you wanted, just the two of you.
My two bills.
That's a couple, yeah.
And then also. Good afternoon again, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm going to start with 3466. As you know,
state of Oregon has taken this type of behavior from a defendant in a case where he is charged with domestic violence or sexual assault seriously for at least 15 years. We've had it required that in a release agreement, a defendant be told he may not contact a victim in order to ensure that the case is not in some way hampered. We then, in 2011, passed that this no-contact order would also be given to the defendant while in custody. It is entered at intake. We're just asking that in the 3466, we're just adding language that would make it so that it's clear that that contact starts at any attempt to do so and may not be done through a third party. When a domestic violence abuser is attempting to maintain control of the situation and police have already stepped in, they're going to do what they can to influence the victim. That intent to influence is manifested by just attempting to make that phone call, attempting to get another person to make contact. So it's important that we make it clear that those attempts are just the same type of thing. They can have the deterrent effect, they can have your cases. And it's important that it is understood that those things are also not going to be allowed in the court system. So I would ask that the 3466 be supported.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We have no problem with the bill as it's written, but we do ask for an amendment that clarifies something. And I have to confess to counsel, I don't know the difference between the dash one and the dash two. I'm staring at it and I don't see a difference.
They're exactly the same.
Thank you. I thought so. All right. All we wanted to have clarified was the prohibition against contact by third parties does not include defense counsel or an agent of the defense counsel operating in the course of doing their defense. And so we just wanted that clarified. The dash one and the dash two do that for us. They both clarify that any attempted contact or contact by the defense attorney or the agent of the defense attorney must be done in the manner prescribed by ORS 135.970, which is what we call reverse Miranda. It's basically a statutory obligation on defense counsel when contacting a victim of a crime. We have to affirmatively hand them a letter and that informs them that who the defense is. And so it reads, if contacted by the defense or an agent of the defense, the victim must be clearly informed by the defense or other contacting agent, either in person or in writing, of the identity and capacity of the person contacting the victim. So we clearly identify for them, we represent the accused. And then it goes on and says that the victim does not have to talk to the defendant's attorney or other agents of the defendant or provide other discovery unless the victim wishes. And the victim may have a district attorney, assistant attorney general, or other attorney or advocate present during interview or other contact. So our amendment incorporates that language and says that if done in the course of compliance with that, that the defense may contact the victim. I'll just say that the defense attorney, the defense team, has ethical and constitutional obligations to investigate. So we just wanted it clarified.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions to anybody? Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearings in House Bill 3466.
We have still have testimony to take on 3469.
Okay.
So why don't we open that here? Which one is that?
Is this from
Michelle, Rachel. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. So, I'm sorry. 3469. Rachel, go ahead, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I apologize. I didn't put it all together at the same time previously. Again, testifying for the AA in support of 3469. As you know, the state of Oregon started taking elevating certain types of assaults very seriously when domestic violence is involved in 1997. Elevating it to a felony from misdemeanor when it's the same victim from a previous case conviction, as well as when a child has witnessed the crime. We then, in 1999, increased it from an A misdemeanor to a C felony in domestic violence situations where there have been three previous domestic violence convictions of an assault four, and we clarified that a child could, that child witnessing is also immediate presence of a child. In 2003, the strangulation law was passed, making strangulation an A misdemeanor. And in 2009, we made assault four a C felony when the victim is known to be pregnant by the defendant. And then in 2011, we made it so that strangulation was no longer just an A misdemeanor, but also a C felony in many scenarios. And at this point, we're just asking that we continue to take assault and strangulation and domestic violence to be a serious situation, and that it should be elevated in the same types of situations in both crimes, in both the strangulation and the assault for crime. This will be beneficial to the safety of victims. It will be beneficial to their families, the safety of the community. And it's important that in these situations, which have been demonstrated to be more lethal and more more concerning by the behavior itself, that we are taking them seriously under both crimes in the same way. And frankly, it also helps clarify things for the officers who are out on the street having to make these decisions about what they need to be doing and when and how. So I am asking that there be support for 3469. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Sure.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. There are various persons, various reasons for relating the punishment to the crime. And in this case, is this a hope that it will prevent crimes from happening, that changing it from one level of felony to a different level of felony will mean that an abuser is less likely to do the deed, or is it a matter of retribution? I'm not sure what the objective is here.
Some of it can be preventative, and some of it can be ensuring that the penalty does fit the crime itself. In these situations, because they have been demonstrated already to be more lethal situations for the victims involved, we want to make sure that that is therefore addressed properly.
I'm sorry, what's more lethal?
It's more lethal, for example, strangulation of of a pregnant woman is something that's considered to be more difficult, more lethal because it involves a fetus as well. When we're looking at a situation where somebody has been previously convicted of three domestic violence crimes, you're looking at somebody who is more likely to continue to commit those crimes, and then we know that the more often domestic violence crime is committed, the more likely a lethality will occur in the future. So certainly is looking at prevention.
No, I understand that, but I'm not sure how that finding applies to this. I understand that somebody who does it frequently is likely to continue doing it. That's not what this is about exactly, is it?
Much of it is that, in that we already have in the assault four statute certain provisions that elevate the crime from an A misdemeanor to a C felony. And we already have provisions in the strangulation statute that elevates it from an A misdemeanor to a C felony. We're asking that because it's been determined that those are situations that are more concerning, that we mirror the two statutes so that they are the same.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Okay,
next item on the agenda, we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3206. I'm going to need to step out for a second. I'll ask Vice Chair Williamson to grab the gavel. Thank you.
Call me whatever you want. Chair Williamson, members of the committee, House Bill 3206 comes to this committee from Representative Barker, Representative Williamson, Representative Leiniger, and Senator Przanski. The bill modifies Oregon statutes regarding post-conviction DNA testing. It permits any person convicted of an offense with relevant DNA evidence to file motion for DNA testing. It changes the prima facie showing in order to obtain DNA testing. It requires the court to place the reason on the record for denying a motion. In addition, it modifies the appointment of counsel process and who may conduct the DNA testing. We don't have any fiscals yet on the bill.
Yeah, thank you. I'm going to invite Steve Wax and his panel up first. And I'll go in any order you'd like, but please state your name for the record. Good afternoon.
Members of the committee, my name is Michelle Feldman, and I'm a state policy advocate at the Innocence Project. We're a national organization that works to exonerate wrongfully convicted people using DNA evidence. And everybody has an interest in overturning a wrongful conviction, because when an innocent person is convicted, then the real perpetrator can be out harming others. Real perpetrators have been identified in 160 of the nation's 325 DNA exonerations, and the actual criminals in these cases went on to commit and be convicted of 145 additional crimes while the innocent person was behind bars, and that includes 78 rapes and 34 murders. So there's a real public safety implication. The numbers show that it is important to have effective post-conviction DNA testing laws that permit fair access to crime-solving technology. And now that all 50 states have these laws in place, we have the benefit of knowing areas that can be improved, and we're going around the country to try to fix these areas. House Bill 3206 would significantly strengthen the post-conviction DNA testing law and align it with statutes in many other states, and better enable the wrongfully convicted to prove their innocence and law enforcement to identify the truly guilty. Under the current law, a person who is no longer incarcerated can only access testing if he or she has been convicted of aggravated murder, murder, or a sex crime. However, people who are no longer in prison are not eligible if they have been convicted of crimes including manslaughter, robbery, and kidnapping. You might wonder why someone would wait until they're out of prison to seek DNA testing. But the reality is that filing a motion for post-conviction DNA testing is very complicated, and often only an organization like the Innocence Project with technical expertise can successfully file a motion. And the National Project has a multi-year backlog of cases, so it's not uncommon for somebody to file, to contact us while they're still in prison, and for us not to accept their case until they've been released. While being out of prison may end one nightmare for an innocent person, they will still likely face collateral consequences, including sex offender registration, barriers to housing and employment, and social stigma. And Ted Bradford, who is here today and is the first DNA exoneree from Washington State, can speak more to that. Mr. Bradford is one of 22 people nationwide who has been exonerated with DNA evidence after incarceration. The real perpetrator was later identified and convicted in 8 of these cases, and had these wrongfully convicted people not been allowed to access testing, the true criminals may not have been ever brought to justice. Based on the experiences in 37 other states that do not have an incarceration requirement, this provision will not result in an uptick in the number of petitions filed. And it will not strain court resources. Nationwide, the Innocence Project has 244 active cases, and only 12 involve clients who are no longer incarcerated. And we found that only the truly innocent have incentive to seek testing after prison, because any unfavorable results can negatively impact their post-release supervision. 3206 would expand eligibility for post-conviction testing to any crime with available DNA evidence. Under the current law, a person is eligible to file a motion if they have been convicted of aggravated murder or a person felony, but that excludes people who have been convicted of other crimes for which DNA evidence can be probative, such as sexual abuse in the third degree, offensive sexual contact, and strangulation. In 21 other states, defendants are eligible for testing for any crime, and none have reported a flood of litigation. This includes Minnesota, where only 5 petitions have been filed since the law was enacted in 2005, and it also includes Wisconsin, where only 46 petitions have been filed by the Wisconsin Innocence Project since the law took effect in 2001. And while House Bill 3206 expands eligibility for testing, it would not impact evidence preservation requirements. The current law requires evidence to be preserved for 60 years from the date of conviction for murder, rape, sodomy, or unlawful sexual penetration, or until the sentence is completed for aggravated vehicular homicide and manslaughter. The evidence preservation law is already narrower than the scope of post-conviction DNA testing law in Oregon, and nothing in this proposal requires it to be expanded. You may hear that this legislation would harm the finality of judgment, but the innocent victims and communities deserve the truth when a wrongful conviction occurs. And thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill, and I can take any questions.
Go on.
Vice Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Aliza Kaplan. I am a law professor at Lewis and Clark Law School. I am also, just last year, the co-founder of the Oregon Innocence Project. Just to make sure everyone knows what the Oregon Innocence Project is, our mission is to exonerate the wrongfully convicted, educate and train law students, and promote legal reforms aimed at preventing wrongful convictions. Previously, I served as the deputy director of the National Innocence Project, and I also co-founded the New England Innocence Project in 2000. And I've taught wrongful conviction clinics and classes for more than 10 years, and I've worked directly or as a consultant on dozens and dozens of cases around the country. I want to just stress that, as many of you know, that since the first DNA exoneration in 1989, DNA evidence has transformed the fabric of our criminal justice system. And DNA-driven discoveries have forced our communities to acknowledge that even the most advanced criminal justice system in the world, ours, makes mistakes that results in innocent people being wrongfully convicted and imprisoned. When DNA testing first became available and through its early years, it provided little help to people that were in prison wrongfully because they had no mechanism to bring their claim and access the DNA technology. So in response, in the early 2000s, states like Oregon began passing and enacting post-conviction DNA testing laws that would provide this avenue for people to access their evidence, conduct DNA testing, and prove their innocence. Oregon was one of the first states to do this in 2001 with all great intent to help those who are wrongfully convicted. But now, today, as my colleague mentioned, 50 states have DNA laws. Many of them were passed more recently. And we have the benefit of all these years later to really learn what needs to be improved. To the Oregon Innocence Project's knowledge, there have only been two successful requests for testing, so only two testing requests granted in the 14 years that Oregon has had this law on the books. Oregon statute needs to be revisited to fulfill its potential of enabling justice for the wrongfully convicted, for the victims, for our communities. I want to note also that the Legislative Fiscal Office determined and posted earlier today that this proposed legislation in House Bill 3206 will have a minimal expenditure impact on state or local government. And I also want to address three important changes to the law. First, House Bill 3206 would create a more reasonable standard to access testing. The current law directs a court to order testing if it finds there is a reasonable possibility that the testing will produce exculpatory evidence that would establish the innocence of the person. This standard, however, creates a catch-22 situation. It essentially requires the person to prove his or her innocence before testing is granted. However, the whole purpose of the testing in the first place, right, is to determine guilt or innocence after the results are in. House Bill 3206 would allow a court to grant testing if it finds that there's a reasonable possibility that the testing results would have led to a non-conviction or to a lesser sentence at the original trial. A court would only apply this standard after the petitioner has filed an affidavit setting forth his innocence or her innocence, identifying the evidence to be tested, and meeting the prima facie requirements of the law. Second, 3206 would promote transparency by requiring the judge to state the reasons for denying the motion for testing. As I mentioned, we know that there are only two requests for post-conviction testing that have been granted, and that the majority of the requests have been denied, but we don't know why. So providing a clear explanation by the court on the record would improve the process by helping attorneys and defendants understand how the statute's being applied, and with the stronger initial petitions, it could help reduce the number of appeals. And third and finally, 3206 would improve meaningful access to post-conviction DNA testing for the wrongfully convicted by expanding eligibility for testing to individuals. While my colleague discussed this provision in more detail, I want to just add that there are already seven states that have statutes with a similar framework to 3206. All of these seven states do not have an incarceration requirement like House Bill 3206. They all allow post-conviction DNA testing for any crime, like House Bill 3206, and they all have a similar legal standard to House Bill 3206. Those states are Hawaii, Missouri, Nebraska, New York, North Carolina, Texas, and Wisconsin. None of these states have reported a flood of litigation. I'll give you a few examples. Hawaii, two petitions have been filed since the law was enacted in 2006. Nebraska, 25 petitions have been filed since the law took effect in 2001. You mentioned Wisconsin, 46 petitions since 2001. And Texas, which has a prison population more than 10 times that of Oregon, has approximately 100 petitions filed each year. 3206 would increase transparency and fairness in post-conviction DNA testing and help ensure that Oregon's criminal justice system can correct wrongful convictions when they occur. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss this.
Vice Chair Williamson, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Wax. I am the legal director of Oregon's New Innocence Project, a former prosecutor, although it was many, many years ago, and recently for 31 years, the federal defender here in Oregon, during which time I either personally represented or supervised the representation of thousands of federal habeas corpus cases challenging convictions that were obtained in the state system. I'm going to address a couple of specific practical aspects of the testing situation and offer some thoughts about what this bill does not do that I think are important to keep in mind in light of the testimony that I anticipate you may be hearing from the District Attorneys Association as reflected in a letter that they submitted to you. First, one of the things that the amendment proposes is to take the word specific out of the current statute. Right now, the statute requires a petitioner to identify the specific evidence that he wants tested. In the real world, that's unworkable. What we have suggested is that a petitioner need to specify the evidence. Well, the example that perhaps is easy to identify is a petitioner would say under the amended statute, there is evidence in the rape kit. Under the existing language, specific evidence would require a person to say, for example, that he wants to have a particular swab that was taken from a particular part of the victim's body tested. A prisoner just can't know that. It's an unworkable part of the existing statute. With respect to the change in the standard that you've just heard about, to take out the word innocence from one portion of the statute, critical to keep in mind that the statute does not limit the showing to expand the showing to things beyond innocence. What the statute would continue to require from a petitioner is a statement of innocence. The statute would continue to require that the petitioner identify a theory of the defense that the DNA testing would support. And the statute continues to require the court to find those elements present before it can order the testing. What the statute is intended to do is to recognize the reality of the DNA testing world. In relatively few cases will DNA evidence in and of itself lead to an exoneration. What is more often the case in the real world, the experience that we have found here in Oregon in cases in which I personally participated and in other states, is that a DNA test will open other avenues of investigation. And the proposed amendment makes clear that that will be enough. And it can only be enough, again, if in the context of the statement of innocence and the theory of defense that explains why and how the DNA testing would lead to a finding that the person is indeed innocent down the road. With respect to the testing, one of the other points that the district attorneys make is that the testing should remain within the Oregon State Crime Laboratory. The proposed amendment continues to have the Oregon State Police Crime Laboratory as the presumptive place for the testing. What it recognizes, however, is that the Oregon State Crime Lab is not equipped to do some of the most sophisticated testing that is sometimes required. And indeed, there is a case right now pending in the state courts here in which the tests had to be performed by a lab outside of Oregon because of the very highly specific nature of the evidence and what was required. Testing would be performed by a lab other than the State Police Crime Lab only on agreement of the parties, which is my understanding of what happened in the one case in which that is happening now, or a court finding good cause for that to happen, that is, that there is an issue with the crime lab. Let me stop at that point. Thank you very much for your time, and I will turn it over to Mr. Bradford.
Good afternoon. My name is Ted Bradford. I just wanted to say thank you for taking the time and allowing me to speak today and share my experience with you. I'm the first person to be exonerated in Washington State through the use of DNA testing. In 1996, I was wrongly convicted and sentenced to 10 years in prison for the crime of first-degree rape in Yakima, Washington. I went through all my state appeals after I was incarcerated. Unfortunately, those did not go through. And in 2001, I contacted the Innocence Project Northwest, an organization based in Seattle, Washington, and asked for their assistance in. They took my case in 2002, and one of the first steps they tried to do was get the testing done on the crime scene evidence. And that was the first struggle for them and for myself. When they did the testing on the crime scene evidence, they discovered an unknown male's DNA profile, which excluded me. And so, armed with that, we went to court and petitioned for the right to a new trial based on this new DNA evidence, which we won in 2007. So, at that time, I thought my nightmare was over, but it was not. 'Cause unfortunately, in 2008, the prosecutor in Yakima decided to try me again for the same crime. And so I was arrested, spent a night in jail. They set another trial date, which took place in 2010, where I was acquitted on all charges and exonerated. The struggle took 15 years of my life, years that I will never get back. At the time when I was first locked up, I was married, had a good job. We had two small children. They were both under 2 years of age. And I missed out on my son and my daughter growing up. I missed out on their birthdays, first days of school. I missed out on a lot. And I just wanted to say I'm here to support this bill. because it sounds to me like it was designed for individuals like myself who are wrongly convicted, have no other avenue, I guess you would say, no way to receive justice and freedom. So I'm here today to support this bill being passed, and I ask that you do that. And I'd be glad to answer any questions if you have any.
Want me to run?
Yeah, please.
All right. I just want to thank you for being here, and your wife, Jolene. I know this was really difficult for you to get up in front of us, but it was such an important testimony to hear. And so I'm wondering from the panel if there are questions. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm, Ted, thank you very much. Sorry to hear that for you. I really am.
Thank you.
Okay, so I'm looking at the current statute, and I know that was mentioned initially at the very beginning of the testimony. Sex abuse 3 was going to be identified as one of those crimes now that you're wanting to shift DNA evidence down. Do you know what the percentage is of how many sex abuse 3 crimes are investigated where DNA evidence is present?
Well, generally, there's only probative DNA evidence available in 5 to 10% of criminal cases. So that would, I would think it would be a very small number. So that's why we don't expect that by opening these crime categories, it will significantly increase the DNA petitions, just because DNA evidence is not available and probative in so many cases.
Okay. Can you give, okay. So I'm reading, I know what the existing law is right now. That it for it is it, it also extends to person felonies.
Mm-hmm.
Has the court? Can you give me any incidents where the courts have misunderstood or misapplied the existing law, right now?
The short answer is yes. There is one case of which we are aware. In which the state conceded error. It had to do with an assignment of counsel issue. The larger answer is we don't know in many instances because the courts are often giving no reason. They're just summarily denying the motions for testing. And one of the things that we asked the State Public Defender's Office to do was to pull together a list of the cases that they currently have on appeal. And of those, somewhere between a quarter and a third are situations in which there was a summary denial. The list of cases that we were provided, has, some ongoing disputes about interpretation of the language. I'm not aware of any confusion in the existing law about the types of offenses for which testing might, be available. That is not something that I'm aware is unclear. Our suggestion for the amendment, has to do with the question of why should anyone who has, in any situation in which DNA could lead to exoneration, why should anyone be excluded? As we have looked around the country and considered the situation here in Oregon, it does not appear as though there would be many cases. Now, I can't tell you whether it would be an increase in 3 or an increase in 30. We just don't know. Whatever it is, it's likely to be very small. Reality is there won't be DNA evidence in many cases. But one of the things that people like Mr. Bradford have learned is that the stigma of a conviction, felony or misdemeanor, is real. And as I'm sure you're aware, there are a number of, check the box or, bills currently pending in which people are testifying about how the effect of a felony conviction and, in some instances, a misdemeanor conviction really upset life. And our belief is very minimal impact, and really, why not? I mean, it's hard to see why we would limit the crimes.
Okay, follow up. Okay, I'm interested in knowing, you started out answering my question that there was one case. I'd like to know what that is. And then...
Can I also add to what Steve said? Because Steve's looking at what OPDS has regarding appeals, but there was not an appeal provision in the statute until all of you passed one in 2013 to no opposition. So we had until 2013, we only know basically post 2013, OPDS reached out and said, if you have a case and you want to appeal it, let me know. And they got a handful based on that. Other than that, it's really unclear because there was no appeal provision. But there certainly were a lot of people filing pro se and having, and I've seen some of these, and a judge just writing denied on top. So it's unclear what about there, was it because it was a pro se petition and the person prisoner wrote themselves and they never got the lawyer to help them? Were they missing something? So there were likely more than even these handful of cases that we know of where they were being summarily dismissed.
Okay, Madam Chair, mm-hmm. Okay, but you're talking about post 2013, right?
So these cases are post appeal. Right. Provision.
I'm talking specifically what the law is today.
Right. The law is today, yeah. I'm sorry. You're right. With the appeal provision.
Right.
Correct.
Questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gail and Russ, or the other two. Russ Rado. Yeah.
Co-Chair Williamson, Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We're in full support of this bill. In our view, post-conviction DNA testing is really a quality assurance program, and it provides a safety net that is currently lacking and absent in our system of justice. And what we love about the American system of justice, we really think it's one of the best in the world, but there are inherent weaknesses, and those weaknesses are this is a system that's really comprised of human beings, one to the next, passing on the baton, the relating what happened and elements of job duties and descriptions and whatnot, but from the event itself to the witnesses to the investigating agencies to the prosecution to the defense of it to the jury and onward, it is all comprised of human beings, and human beings make mistakes. One thing that I do want to acknowledge here is that sometimes it's the defense lawyers that make the mistakes too. The element of confirmatory bias in the concept of a criminal prosecution is very, very real, but defense lawyers are not immune to it. And I say that in just transparency and honesty. You see amongst the exonerees that have now been exonerated nationwide with DNA testing, there definitely have been those instances when the defense lawyer was very, very, very zealous and was advocating for their client till the end, maintaining innocence. There are also very painful instances when the defense lawyer was as surprised as everyone else with the DNA exoneration of their own client. So what we would submit that there is no harm in opening this up as broad as can be. If someone comes forward and says there may be some evidence here that could have been outcome determinative, let me get it tested, it's a good thing to let it get tested. There is no DNA is one of those godsends that really can give a sense of assurance, where in the past it's all been reliance on human memory and human understanding, and that has its frailties and its faults. So we are definitely very much in support of the bill and hope that the committee embraces it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Russ Ratto. I'm a Multnomah County Deputy District Attorney, and I've worked in that capacity for 35 years. I've worked in a variety of...
Can you pull one of the mics towards you? Thanks.
Again, my name is Russ Ratto. I'm a Multnomah County Deputy District Attorney, and I've worked in that capacity for 35 years. I've worked on a variety of kinds of cases, misdemeanors to felonies, to serious felonies, to sexual assaults, murders, ag murder, aggravated murder. Recently, Multnomah County District Attorney Rod Underhill assigned me to a new position. It's a new position in the state of Oregon. There are very few positions of this nature across the nation, a post-conviction deputy district attorney. This responsibility that he has given to me has me looking at the administrative or best practices within the district attorney's office, discovery obligations, eyewitness identification, interview recording, ethics, forensic identification rules, evidence retention, proffer agreements, file closing. I'm also responsible for looking in our office at conviction integrity. That includes claims of actual innocence, and that involves me in looking at this very kind of case we're talking about under the statute, DNA testing, to establish actual innocence. I also look at clemency matters, post-conviction relief cases, handling parole board matters, as well as the PSRB. So when I speak to you today, it's based upon personal experience in this area of law. I'm also speaking on behalf of the District Attorney, Rod Underhill, and I've been asked to speak to you on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We oppose this bill, and I'd like to tell you why. This bill seeks to amend what is a good statute that addresses the actually innocent individuals who would have their DNA tested in the existing evidence to establish their innocence. That testing then would be changed from establishing actual innocence to instead lead to a finding, testing that would lead to a finding the person could not be convicted. That's a huge expansion of the nature of the test, the reason for the test, and the consequence of the test. You have heard in the testimony interuse interchanged of the words wrongful conviction and actual innocence, but those are two different concepts. This bill seeks to expand the testing beyond the exoneration of the actually innocent and to instead replace it with a new system that would allow challenges to convictions that go beyond the actual innocent, rather to whether or not the state can prove its case at a later date, whether or not the state could once again carry its burden beyond a reasonable doubt. That does challenge finality. We have a good system right now in place that addresses the risk of wrongful conviction. We have public trials. We have requirements of arrest and arraignment. We have discovery obligations. We have defendants receiving a right to trial a right to a new trial upon conviction. They have the right to appeal. They have the right to counsel. They have the right to post-conviction relief. They have the right to appeal post-conviction relief. They have the right to federal habeas corpus review. And all the while, they also have the right to seek parole in a certain variety of cases. It is in the system that we have great protections. And we also have within our system this right for DNA testing to exonerate the actually innocent. The change that is proposed would greatly expand then the time, the litigation expenses that follow, court-appointed attorney costs, appeals, as both sides would have the right to appeal both the decision to test or not to test, as well as the court's follow-up hearing when the test results come back. There's a right of appeal at that stage as well. There's a right to appeal the motion for new trial that would follow. Victims have an interest in seeing that if there's a wrong person in custody, that that person is released, just as district attorneys do. If there's an innocent person in custody, we want that person out. But we don't want to have to retry a case years after the fact, a person that's previously been found guilty. And that is what this statute would do, and it would not be tied to whether or not that person is actually innocent. The statute changes the wording. It would permit testing that would lead to a finding of a person who would not have been otherwise convicted. And the examples provided today do not justify that change of wording. I'd like to talk to you about several examples that I believe illustrate why that change is unnecessary and risky. In 1985, a 13-year-old child encountered this individual who befriended her. He was 17 years of age. They went back to her mother's home, her foster mother's home, and received permission to go out and walk the dogs. She was taken down to Oaks Bottom, where he stabbed her to death. He was caught, he confessed, he was convicted, he was incarcerated. His confession makes it clear that DNA testing is not necessary. He is not factually innocent. But if the statute is changed, it is that kind of test that would allow testing of a murder weapon, because a defense attorney would argue that the result could lead to a different outcome. Serial rapist. Case that I've personally been involved in, but does not currently involve DNA testing. There was a rape. There was a confession. There was a conviction. But if the statute is changed, he could argue that testing should be performed because it would be a potentially determinative fact. Confessions can be litigated as they have been in the past. They could be litigated in the future. It's changing the rules of the game. It's opening up cases. In 1981, we had a 7-year-old child who went to the park to pick up pop cans. He went into this offender's home on the ruse that he would receive some money, some pop cans, never to be seen again. The offender admitted that he sexually assaulted the child. The child's body was left in a dumpster, never to be recovered. Again, confession. No claim of actual innocence, but if you change the statute, that's the kind of case you open up.
Strato, I want to go ahead and invite someone who drafted the bill to come up so that we can ask questions of both of you about these scenarios.
And then I'd like to just, Chair Barker and members of the committee, I'd like to just make one other point. It is helpful sometimes when we think about law to look at the public health system. There are procedures that can be envisioned or practices instituted that sometimes bring along with them unintended and unexpected consequences. What makes for better health care? In past instances, we may have performed surgeries wholesale, tonsillectomies, hysterectomies. We may have encouraged the use of antibiotics, only to find that when those drugs or those surgical procedures are employed, there are unexpected consequences. They aren't necessary. They carry health risks. The approach of the measure here in expanding the class of cases and reasons for the testing would make it available for offenders to challenge their convictions beyond when they are actually claiming that they are innocent. And that is the most significant provision of this bill and the basis for our opposition. Now, I've provided to the committee a written summary of the other provisions, and I have copies for members if you don't have a copy, and I'd like to leave it with you. And I am available for questions.
Do you want to start questioning?
Yeah. Let's start with the notion that I'm not a lawyer.
Sure.
I'm a citizen that worries about your definition of wrongly convicted. It seems to me you would include among those who are wrongly convicted those who in fact are innocent and those who are wrongly convicted. You seem to make a big distinction between the two. I'm sure the Innocence Project is very much interested in the question of innocence. I'm pretty interested as well in the question of wrongly convicted without regard to innocence. You seem okay with wrongly convicted. It only troubles you when you wrongly convict somebody if they're actually innocent? Would that be your position? Because I think that's what you just are basing your whole argument on.
I want to make a distinction between legal innocence and factual innocence. This testing procedure was enacted to address those who are actually or factually innocent. Legal innocence is a matter that is determined through court process. And we try cases every day where the state's burden is to prove a case beyond reasonable doubt. We have, over years and experience, learned to change our practices to have a better system of delivered justice so that we don't convict legally innocent people. But when they are convicted, they are legally guilty. And this statute attempts to change the testing process from allowing factually innocent people to have their DNA tested to having those who challenge their legal guilt to have DNA tests that has, at that point, not the relevance to their actual innocence, but to the ability to challenge and prove, require the state to prove its case later on, 20 or 30 years later, where we'd have to come back and get our witnesses, we'd be relitigating the same facts, but the state now would be handicapped significantly.
But your issue, I am just as concerned about wrongly convicted, and you argue that if somebody's wrongly convicted, that's okay, as long as they're not arguing for their factual innocence.
No, I'm not trying to say that.
Okay, I'm sorry.
What I'm trying to say is that if we're going to conduct DNA testing by statute, it should be targeted to those who are factually innocent.
Why?
Because it is the test that clearly establishes that they should not be convicted. The other matters you talk about are disputes. And the concept of finality should not have us revisit judgments, criminal judgments, or civil judgments years later to revisit these matters, to question, was the ID right, or was the confession right? This statute doesn't get to that, and it shouldn't. We have a post-conviction relief statute that allows, within 2 years after judgment, the right to come back to the court system and say what happened was wrong. We have a right to seek a new trial within 10 days, and judgment has to be rendered by the court within 55 days unless good cause is shown. There are procedures that allow defendants to say, here is new evidence. I have been wrongfully convicted, notwithstanding discovery and criminal trial practice. But you're talking about, and the examples I'm discussing today are the cases that we see coming up under this measure of 10, 20, and 30-year-old cases. And that's why, for this statute, dealing with DNA testing, it is our position that it should be targeted strictly to those who are claiming innocent, factual innocence. And there was something that the law professor said, Ms. Kaplan said, that I disagree with, and that is, in order to obtain a test for DNA, the court would assume an exculpatory result that would establish the actual innocence, then find a reasonable possibility that the testing would produce the prima facie showing of actual innocence. The proposal here is assuming exculpatory results, the result would lead to finding the person would not have been convicted. So my difference of opinion in terms of what the present statute says and even the proposed statute, the present statute says assuming the best case for the defendant in what that DNA test will be of the rape kit, and I believe that factually in the Washington case, if I understand correctly, the defendant was exonerated because that DNA test came back and said his DNA is not in the rape kit. Somebody else is there. The problem with that case was the decision of the district attorney. This statute doesn't get to that. If the DA's thinking is mistaken, you have to get rid of the DA, apparently. But the statute won't get to that. In terms of a DNA test, he was exonerated because of the DNA test. It's unfortunate, if not tragic, that he had to go to trial again. But it's fortunate that there was a statute that allowed him to obtain that DNA test. I hope that answers your question. I'm trying to.
And just for folks here who don't know, there's another committee that's starting. So when members are up and running around, that's why. So.
A couple of points. First, Representative Greenlick, while I share the concern that you've been expressing, I disagree with Mr. Addo's interpretation of the statute. You know, as indicated previously, in order to get testing, the petitioner would have to swear, prepare an affidavit that says, I am innocent. It's not enough under the proposed amendment for a person to come in and say, well, you know, 30 years ago, I was convicted of something with this little kid, and, I hear there's a knife. You have to say, I'm innocent, and you have to explain how testing could lead to your exoneration. Second point, confessions. One of the things that Mr. Bradford did not say is he confessed. Critical to keep in mind that 25% of all cases that are on the National Registry of Exonerations have involved either confessions or pleas of guilty. False confessions and pleas of guilty by people who are innocent are a very unfortunate reality of our system. And one of the things that the DNA testing statute does today and would allow if amended is a person who confessed or pled guilty to say that was a false confession. So I think that to focus on confessions as a basis to say, as one of the cases, Representative Olson, Vice Chair Olson, one of the cases that is on appeal, involved a trial court saying, well, you confessed, and it looked to me like your confession had some internal integrity. Therefore, I'm denying the request for testing. And, you know, maybe the same result is obtained if the statute is amended, but that's one of the problems that we have in the system in terms of the impact of confessions and the fact that they are not always accurate.
Yeah, I'll just add to the timing issue that Mr. Addo brought up. You know, there's in all the 325 cases of DNA exonerations around this country, they don't happen in those first 2 years of when you do have an option for post-conviction relief. And the types of claims and the type of investigations that are necessary in these cases, even if the person filed the day after, you know, they were all their appeals were done, it's very often the case that it takes a lot longer than 2 years to reinvestigate a case. In fact, it always does. And secondly, to access the evidence and get the DNA testing. These cases, unfortunately, take a really long time. I have never had a quick case I have never had a case where I've just asked for the DNA and I was given the evidence and I was given it and then I did testing and then the person came out. The reason these many of the people you see on the news and the newspaper walking out 20 years, 30 years later is because the combination of the DNA technology changing and becoming available, combined with that these cases can take a really long time for the person to find someone to help them and reinvestigate the case, access the evidence, have testing done. So there's a lot of things that go into the time frame. So the argument that, oh, they have a mechanism in post-conviction, there isn't even a real mechanism under post-conviction law to bring an innocence claim yet. So it's not realistic in the way these cases work.
And all of this assumes that there's evidence, DNA, that's been...
Right, and so on to the types of crimes which were mentioned. Not only are there only 5 to 10% of cases where there's probative DNA evidence, you also have to think about the types of cases that this law might be, quote, expanding to, they have to be cases where someone takes the DNA. And many of the types of crimes that have been added are cases where there probably won't even be DNA because they're not the kinds of cases where we take DNA. So we're looking at, you know, that piece. We're looking at time going by and whether there's preservation. But what we're saying is that if there's any chance at all, that we can find the evidence from someone's case and we can subject it to DNA testing and it could prove innocence, let's give the person a chance. And let's not put so many conditions on it. Let's give them an opportunity. And the 325 cases around the country show that all the stars have to align for each one of these people to be exonerated. So let's not throw barriers that they don't need in front of them to get to justice.
Do you have one more minute?
Yes.
The question of actual innocence and what DNA shows. Again, Mr. Bradford's case. The prosecutor in that case, perhaps he should have been thrown out of office, but we don't need to go there. What he said was, this evidence that has been found on the underside of the tape inside the mask worn by the rapist does not in and of itself establish actual innocence. And that's a position that some of us may disagree with, but I don't think that it is an irrational position. The problem is, in many of these DNA cases, what the DNA does is open up the avenue of investigation. In that case, they found someone else's DNA on what was agreed to be the mask worn by the rapist in a place where someone other than the rapist would, in all likelihood, not have touched. But then there was further investigation, and the amendment is intended to ensure that, if I may be graphic, if you find semen in a woman's vagina and it is not the defendant's and the only person with whom she had sex was the rapist, that DNA, in all likelihood, everyone would agree, in and of itself is exonerating. In many other situations, the DNA is the first step that hopefully the parties can agree to jointly be taking to see who the real perpetrator is. Thank you so much for
thank you.
For
my point with us. Would be you do not need to change the statute to get to testing of that DNA, and instead by changing the statute you have profound effects upon the system.
Any other questions from the panel? All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 3206 and close the hearing on House Bill 3469. You want your gavel back, Mr. Chair? All right.
Go ahead. Close it up.
Take it.
You're adjourned. You can go to... You're adjourned. You can go...
Close it up.